the last few decades, when we defeat a bad thing from happening within the labor movement, we rightly celebrate it as a win. But it's also a bit of a sign of why we need to build our power to be able to go in the offensive. We don't need to always be talking about how we won by defeating the bad thing. We need to be getting to the point where we're winning new things.
I think our feeling for it would be that a lot of companies and organizations of this type, global corporations, at a certain point in their evolution decide at some point, consciously or unconsciously, to stop being the disruptor that capitalism throws up and start putting down roots.
I got this 4x6 card printed up and I would put it in the bathroom and give people my phone number so that if they didn't want to talk to me, but like they wanted to talk to me privately, they could do that. So I would just go into the men's room and then into the women's room and drop the cards off at the mirror. And ultimately 40 people contacted me.
Daryl goes out of his way to immediately just say, "Are you on our side, Michael? Recruit him into the cause." And then he goes to Jan, and one of the first things he says to Jan is, "The warehouse workers are talking about unionizing, and they make some really good points." So.
The response was immediate. Within an hour, the plant was virtually shut down. 6,000 workers voted to continue the strike. Wildcat leaders noted that virtually all the routine antagonisms among workers, young versus old, black versus white, women versus men, had melted away in solidarity.
Welcome to the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labour Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, we'll start with America's Workforce Radio, where David Van Dusen, the president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, explains how the United Slate won control of the state Fed and how they're plotting the path for a different approach to union politics. In a special episode of Union Dues, Simon talks to Martin Smith, national organiser for the GMB, about the union's landmark agreement with Uber drivers in the United Kingdom. On the Solidarity Works podcast, author and organiser Anne Bailey tells us the backstory and how she researched a groundbreaking study of gay, lesbian and transgender workers in the steel industry. Next, how would you organise a union in the office? Not any old office, but the office of Dunder Mifflin, the subject of the popular television show. This week's Labour Wave Radio, Elizabeth Lasak will consider that very question. Then finally, we'll return to the Dodge truck plant in Warren, Michigan in June 1974, where contract negotiations have stalled and auto workers' patience is wearing thin. Rick Smith will tell us what happened next. We've got reports today from America's Workforce Radio, Union Dues, Solidarity Works, Labour Wave Radio, and we'll finish off with Labour History in Two. This is Patrick Dixon for the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly. Here we go.
The America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Farron.
Let's go to line number one, and joining us from Vermont is David Van Dusen. David is president of the Vermont AFL-CIO. Once again, this is a series of state labor federations we've been checking into, and the list is close to about 15 now. And we just want to get a flavor of what's going on in various parts of the country, from places like Vermont to California to West Virginia. Right-to-work states, progressive states, and I think Vermont definitely is in the progressive category. David Van Dusen, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, pleasure to be with you today.
David, why don't you give us a little background on yourself? You've been president for a couple of years now. How did you rise up the union ranks? Talk to me about that first before we get into some of the specifics there.
Sure. I'm a member of AFSCME Local 2413. And a few years back, myself and along with a coalition of other AFL-CIO unions in Vermont, including the building trades and United Academics, we looked around and we saw that the labor movement really needed to make some changes for us to grow our power and to have the kind of political influence that working people both demand and require to advance an agenda which is favorable to them. So we came together as a coalition. We formed something called the United Slate, and we ran a series of progressive candidates for the leadership of the Vermont AFL-CIO. I'm happy to report that we swept elections both in 2019 and 2020, and the progressive United Slate now has every single leadership position in the Vermont AFL-CIO. We're looking to increase rank and file participation. We're looking to build stronger, deeper alliances with community organizations and racial justice groups. And we're really looking to organize new shops and turn the corner as far as organized labor is concerned.
So you are being very aggressive on that front. You don't have too much time under your belt now. This is just a couple of years, but are you seeing any results so far because of that vote that you created?
Absolutely. We've changed a number of priorities in our labor federation. One of the first things we did is we cut back the amount of resources we put into our traditional lobbying efforts in our state house and instead created an organizing department staffed with part-time on-call organizers, which we now assign to affiliates to help them with internal organizing or external organizing. And right now, as we speak, we have one of those organizers assigned to help build a membership of one of our larger units, AFSCME 1674, and also assigned to United Academics at UVM as they fight against, with the administration, they fight against program cuts and job cuts. So now we're able to provide real, concrete, measurable solidarity with our affiliates, something that we weren't able to do before. So that in and of itself is a big change. We're engaged in a number of new organizing drives, and we have developed really good relationships with a number of community groups, including Migrant Justice, which represents undocumented farm workers in Vermont. So there's tons of work to be done, lots further we have to go. But as a start, we really can already see the effects of having different priorities.
We've featured many state labor federations, and boy, I tell you, Vermont really stands out here from what I've been gathering. To work, a neighboring state, New Hampshire, has been battling this for 6 months. And frankly, I thought it was going to go and turn to right to work. But last week, we found out that wasn't the case. They were able to rally some of the Republican lawmakers there, and it's tabled for now. Just wondering, since you're the neighboring state, did you supply any resources for that battle against right to work, David?
Look, we're always willing to provide whatever solidarity is requested of us from fellow folks within the labor movement. In this case, New Hampshire AFL-CIO had this taken care of. They worked very hard. They defeated this. They worked with the other large unions, affiliated unions like AFSCME, and it's a great win. So, like, I congratulate the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. I congratulate AFSCME over in New Hampshire for this major victory. But let's point something out here. Over the last few decades, when we defeat a bad thing from happening within the labor movement, we rightly celebrate it as a win. But it's also a bit of a sign of why we need to build our power to be able to go in the offensive. We don't need to always be talking about how we won by defeating the bad thing. We need right. to be getting to the point where we're winning new things. So these defensive victories are important. We have to engage in them and we have to prevail. But we need to be stronger and we need to be passing more rights for working class people. This is why we could talk about the PRO Act in Washington, D.C., which would be huge if we could get that passed. However, we still have three Democratic senators who refuse to back it, let alone mm-hmm. getting to the 60% threshold. And then a number of the senators that say they support it, like Joe Manchin out of West Virginia, does not support getting rid of the filibuster. So if you say you support the PRO Act, and yet you say you will not vote to do away with the filibuster, that's less than words on paper, right?
Yeah.
Again, there's a long road in front of us, but we hear all these great promises on the campaign trails from the Democratic Party, but when push comes to shove, why is it that they're unwilling or unable to deliver?
Well said, my man. David, thank you so much for joining us here on America's Workforce Radio and Podcast. You take care, keep up the fight, and please keep in touch with us, all right?
Pleasure to talk to you today. Solidarity.
Welcome to the Union Views Podcast. The UK's only All Things Union podcast, designed for your downloadable digital delight and appreciation. In this special episode, behind the scenes of the GMB Uber historic deal. How did it happen and what does it mean? Hello and welcome to this special edition of Union Jews, the UK's only All Things Union podcast, with me, Simon Sapper. Now, when GMB struck a deal with Uber, a voluntary recognition deal, eyebrows went up around the country, around the world, in fact, given that Uber has a global footprint. How did it happen? How did a union with barely enough members to get anywhere near the statutory recognition process broker a deal to cover 90,000 people, potentially? I had the chance to sit down with the GMB's national organiser, Martin Smith, to ask him what was underneath the bonnet, or hood, if you're in North America, of this historic deal. Martin Smith, head of organising for the GMB. Very welcome to the Union Jews podcast. Thanks for spending some time with us. Obviously, the big news story is the deal with Uber, which is a fascinating issue for many reasons. I'm really intrigued to know what's under the bonnet. I've read the press releases. I've seen the article in Union News, for example. But for an organisation that was part of a $200 million plus effort to banish unions in California, Proposition 22, they must have had some sort of character transplant to be able to reach a voluntary agreement with yourselves. What's the secret, if you're able to say?
I think it's very hard to psychoanalyze a global corporation like Uber, as it was in the past with other companies where we got a deal with, like Walmart in the UK. I think our feeling for it would be that a lot of companies and organizations of this type, global corporations, at a certain point in their evolution, decide at some point, consciously or unconsciously, to stop being the disruptor that capitalism throws up and start putting down roots. And we've seen that in a number of companies. I suppose the equivalent is Amazon in the UK. And what we've seen in Uber is they have now in the UK much more European-based management structure, and actually with their location in London, much more anglicised management structure. So people who are maybe not as instinctively confused by the notion that being part of polite and civic society might mean talking to unions. So I do think that there's been a change in the global structure of the company, and I'd have to take advice from colleagues around the world in the trade union movement, whether other parts of the world have seen this, but there's less and less directive control from the centre globally, from America, than perhaps there was.
So do you think then that this is a kind of evolutionary path that many global companies walk along, or is it the influence of the union? Because there's always been a union presence in Uber. Or is it a combination of the two that decides exactly when this transformation, if you like, happens?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think the union presence in Uber has been, frankly, minimal so far, not enough to have driven this on our own. I think we really would be delusional if we thought that collectively across the world that our combined union strength had on its own, powerful enough to force this change. I think all we can say is when we dealt with the likes of Southern Cross, which was a yellow company, which was a global private equity operation, and with Walmart and with G4S, other companies we've dealt with and got to this similar point within the past have been on that evolutionary road. And so it's quite unbelievable to think that this is the road they're going down. And they're certainly more open to the things that we've been banging on about in the UK now than perhaps they were, obviously, prior to the Supreme Court ruling.
Well, exactly. I was going to say the unionisation in terms of numbers may be not able to exert much influence, but in terms of the legal process and the union, you know, those cases would not have come to court were it not for union activity.
Yeah, and I think part of the process that global corporations, certainly based in the US, particularly where they have a very specific legal climate and culture, part of the process of ending their notion of themselves as a disruptor and, like, you know, joining polite society is recognizing that you cannot just decide to dismiss UK-based employment law, as perhaps Uber in the past was trying to do, because perhaps some of our things that we have in UK employment law, some of it affected over long term by European employment law, just does not fit into a US legal model. And I think that is a common thing that we found certainly in other US-based, specifically global companies in the past, particularly Walmart.
Yeah, yes, indeed. We've had colleagues from the Union of Tech and Allied Workers on a previous edition of the podcast who say that their members who are working in American-owned companies are being given like employment contracts based on American law, which simply are unenforceable in every sense in the UK.
American lawyers could be quite as imperialist as other aspects of American government and society. They seem to believe that everyone fits into American law. So I think if you are a company, let's just posit this as a theory. If you are a company like Uber and you think we really do want a long-term future, we don't just want to disrupt the UK-based private hire and taxi business, well, at some point, you need a management structure that understands civil society in the UK and Europe, and you need a set of lawyers that can navigate Supreme Court judgments and not just pretend you can ignore employment law. And I think we're at that point, and obviously that's where we can start making more progress in terms of agreements.
Brilliant. Martin, thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome.
Anne Bailey spent years researching and developing relationships with gay, lesbian, and trans steelworkers in the Gary, Indiana area, all while training to become a mechanic. Her hard work paid off in 2014, when UNC Press published her first book, Steel Closets, featuring the unique voices and experiences of queer workers in steel mills from Philly to Ontario.
Talking to those 40 people changed my entire life. I can't even describe what it was like to talk to them.
Currently a union organizer, Anne went on to earn her commercial driver's license and publish another book called Semi-Queer, about gay, Black, and trans long-haul truckers in 2018. Today, I'm talking to Anne about both of these books and her personal experiences as a blue-collar worker, a former academic, and a self-professed risk-taker. So when did you start writing that book, and how did you get the access to the folks who worked in the mills? Because I imagine that wouldn't be a very natural thing.
I started writing the book in about 2010. And so originally I just went to the library to look it up to say, oh, so what's the experience of a gay steelworker? But there was nothing. And I mean nothing in any library anywhere about queer steelworkers whatsoever. Nothing. I went out to right outside of Pittsburgh, there's that Steelwood. I went all the way out there. I had made an appointment with the archivist and curator, and they met me in the archives and sat down with me and said, oh, so when you called, we were super into it, and we looked through this entire archive, and there is not a single mention of gay or lesbian or trans people ever. But we know that it's a great environment. Pittsburgh is welcoming. The mills are welcoming. It's not because of bigotry or harassment, so it must just be that there aren't any of you. Sorry, go home. And so at that moment, I knew that there was a valuable research project, because we know perfectly well that streets can be like, oh, it's safe, don't worry, we're very loving and accepting. And if there is absolute silence, that's not true. I just knew that. I knew that the silence was only explicable by fear. But then, like you said, I had to meet people, right? Because the point is that gay and lesbian steel workers are certainly were hiding. So how was I going to meet them? So I just started a long project in which I went to bars, like literally whenever I could. I went to all the local bars. I went to steel bars, gay bars in the area. I just spent a lot of time in bars, serious research. And I like got to know people, and they got to know me. And if I met someone who was at a gay bar, I'd ask if they were a steelworker, if they knew steelworkers. And if I met someone at a steel bar, I asked if they were gay. Like, there were many awkward conversations, as you can imagine. From this, it totally worked. It took a while. An advantage is that I still had my jacket from the car shop, and I always wore that. So that made me seemed relatable. And also, I never confessed to being an English professor. I said that I worked at the college, but I didn't say English professor, because that gives people sudden paranoia that how they're talking to what they're saying. And I don't care about that in any way, but they weren't going to believe that at a bar. So I didn't confess to that. But I ultimately met a lot of people. I got this 4x6 card printed up, and I would put it in the bathroom and give people my phone number so that if they didn't want to talk to me, but like they wanted to talk to me privately, they could do that. So I would just go into the men's room and then into the women's room and drop the cards off at the mirrors. And ultimately 40 people contacted me. I did 40 interviews of gay, lesbian, and trans state workers, mostly in Gary. But I did some in Pittsburgh. I did one outside of Philly. So that's how I found them, in bars.
We steel workers love our bars, that's for sure. Did you learn anything shocking or revealing about what it's like to be queer in a mill? Was there anything that you really weren't expecting or that really blew you away?
Oh, yes, in every way. Talking to those 40 people changed my entire life. I can't even describe what it was like to talk to them. What the job was, what the job is just even just learning that. I talked to a burner whose job was to put on wooden shoes and step out onto the slabs that are hot. That's why you're wooden shoes, and hot is like an understatement, with a bug and burn them into set shapes. And his description of what happened if there had been any water in the mix, and he cut with that water in there and the slab would just explode with him on it. Like the descriptions of the jobs were intense. And you know what I said earlier about risk, like the way that working in that kind of enormous, dangerous work setting is so adrenaline filled. And so like they lit up when they talked about it. In just an amazing way. So that's definitely a thing that I did not have any idea what went on in there. I had never worked in a steel mill. And a bunch of the women in particular that I talked to had gone into the mills when the consent decree went through. So they'd been there at the beginning when they were like the first women ever hired. And they were the toughest people you will ever meet. I got to totally be friends with one of them named Jan Gentry, who was originally hired. She lived in a suburb of Philly as a kid, and her parents worked in a Bethlehem mine, a coal mine. And she was hired into that coal mine as like the first woman ever hired into the coal mine. There were like four women hired. And hazed and harassed, and she always gave back whatever she got and like totally never took any shit from anyone and fought her way through 40 years of working in a steel mill. When that mine closed, she was moved to the Bethlehem steel mill that used to be in outside of Gary. So she moved to cross country and started working in the steel mill, and she was there through any number of changes of ownership. ArcelorMittal owned it when she retired, and she subsequently died of cancer. That's one of the hard parts about the work, is I would get to be so bonded to these people, and we were friends after the book came out, and then they ultimately, I don't know how many of them have died since it came out, like the cancer hits at 60 and there's just a few years left. So that's been a really difficult process for me. But also another thing I learned is how much the mills have changed, right? So they still take up the same footprint. There's still these enormous factories that just look like Dickensian dinosaur, like they're huge, but no one worked there, right? Like automation and shrinking workforce and everything. And that shapes the experience of what it's like to work there. I mean, one of the trans women that I interviewed was a chemist. So she would take samples. That's what chemists do there. And she would get a little sample and have to carry it all across 2 miles being visibly trans. And what that felt like, and just situated in these enormous, even gigantic spaces. There's no way to describe the experience of listening to these people talk. And I love to hear people tell stories. I've always loved it. And they would just go on and on for hours, and it was awesome.
And these stories in steel closets had a really big impact on our union, by the way. The book is one of the reasons why our union eventually formed the LGBTQ Advisory Committee. To learn more about Anne's work and to purchase her books, visit www.anebalay.com. You can also visit usw.org/steelpride to learn more about our union's work fighting for LGBTQ plus members. Until next time, take care and stay safe, siblings. And of course, happy Pride.
Elizabeth Lasak, welcome to Labor Wave.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So we have a fun episode planned today. We're going to be talking about how to unionize the office, the American version, not the British. And this is something that apparently you do a lot in your spare time, is think through different union campaigns in television show scenarios, or I imagine movie scenarios too. What are some of the other ones other than The Office that you've thought about?
I think it's all like under the like same writers, of course, because they set up a workplace so well, like Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Parks and Rec, even like Frasier, because they did have an episode where they also like, well, they had a union, but like how they were organizing to fight, they were losing raises that they were supposed to be getting. And so then I just think about, because like, they were arguing about who the leader should
be. They gave it to Frasier because he could speak well.
And they originally had the guy who was like the Star Trek fan, who his like primary negotiating tactic was fainting. And then Cheers, especially because I worked in the restaurant industry for a while, and it is an extremely difficult place to ever fathom unionizing, because they're all pitted against each other. And you see that in these like different restaurant TV shows.
Yeah, and Cheers, Carla, and I'm forgetting Shelley Duvall's character's name, even though she's like the best.
Diane.
They're at each other's throats all the time.
Together, yes.
Sam Malone is like the biggest sexual harasser in the world.
Yes. Watching it like now, it does not hold up. It is, a lot of it is very offensive. And he hit Diane at one point. He like punched her.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. When they're breaking up.
She hit him quite a bit too, but it was still like weird.
He's the owner. He was the boss.
Yeah.
The office is a similar environment in that it's incredibly toxic and probably the world's worst boss. So I guess I thought what we should do is imagine that we are new employees of the office. So we enter this work environment. And for our listeners, we discussed before we start recording that we're only going to talk about like the first four seasons. We're not trying to get into the whole series, because after a while, the characters change so much that they're not even the same people anymore. But we're just talking about the early years. So we're new employees there, and we see all these problems in the workplace. And we decide we should really start getting these coworkers together and united in a common cause. What do you think would be the first step organizing the office?
So we also talked about prior to recording this that we should rewatch the episode where the warehouse workers talk about unionizing. And so I would have to say the first step, honestly, is telling everybody that this needs to stay a secret. And we can't tell management until we have majority of support.
Because the first thing they do is tell Michael.
And then Michael runs right to jail. And I think a lot of people like to think, especially with somebody like Michael too, who seems like he's your buddy, they're still beholden to other people in one way or another, perhaps romantically even. So yeah, absolutely. Let's keep this private. Let's keep some down low, have some confidential conversations with people to gauge where they stand. But also the most important part is identifying a leader, especially if you and I were new here. Nobody really likes when new folks come into a place and say that maybe we need a union, maybe we need to change things. There's something wrong with the way you're doing things. Instead, it becomes like a like seniority conflict. So actually like talking to people to find out who they respect and look up to.
Yeah, so social mapping would be in order like right off the bat. Before we go to the social mapping, I do want to just remark on what you were saying about Michael. in that I've seen this from other workers where they feel like they have a sympathetic boss, like an immediate supervisor that's nice, that's friendly to them, even though Michael is complicated because he's actually terrible. But at the same time, he's got like a soft heart and people, and you find yourself sympathetic to him as a character. They think Daryl goes out of his way to immediately just say, "Are you on our side, Michael?" and recruit him into the cause. And then he goes to Jan, and one of the first things he says to Jan is, so the warehouse workers are talking about unionizing, and they make some really good points. So he is like on their side at first. But like you said, he's a manager. He's got a function, and his job is to repress and divide and conquer. But I've seen that mistake a lot, and people assume, hey, this one supervisor, this one manager, I think they'd actually be supportive of a union. And I have to talk to people about that. So when you get like workers that have that sentiment, that believe that they can probably convert some of their own management to be on their side, how do you address that?
Yeah, we have that. I'm organizing faculty at the University of Pittsburgh. And often their first response is, if they don't know really anything about a union and this is a new conversation for them, their response is, let me ask my chair what they think. No, please don't do that. You have to frame, and this takes training too. You need to be framing the conversation for where are the issues, and you need to constantly be directing it back to, especially in a place like the office where they all like fight each other. If you're talking to somebody like Angela, it was everybody's stupid. That's why there's problems. And what created this situation, getting them to see that it is coming from the top down to them.
Thanks for joining us on Labor Wave, and let's talk again soon.
Thanks.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1974. That was the day workers at the Dodge truck plant in Warren, Michigan, went out on a wildcat strike. Workers were fed up with the endless attacks from management and disappointing contract negotiations the year before. Wildcat strikes had become almost commonplace in Detroit area auto plants the previous summer. Arbitrary discipline, deteriorating working conditions, and frustration with the union's response all led to the three-day walkout. 10 days earlier, 100 workers had staged a sick-in over working conditions. When the company threatened firings, more workers dropped their tools. Now, 4 had been fired, including the second shift chief steward. The response was immediate. Within an hour, the plant was virtually shut down. 6,000 workers voted to continue the strike. Wildcat leaders noted that virtually all the routine antagonisms among workers, young versus old, black versus white, women versus men, had melted away in solidarity. Socialist and anarchist workers in the plant published their recollections in a commemorative pamphlet entitled Wildcat, Dodge Truck, June 1974. In it, they state, quote, "We were excited by the collective decision of thousands of Chrysler employees to deny the authority of daily wage labor and, for even 4 days, to say no to the demands of the alarm clock, the production line, bosses, union bureaucrats, judges, and cops. It was, in fact, a total frustration with and rejection of all the things inside and outside the plant which exercise control over our lives." By the time it was over, 30 strikers had been arrested. Strike leaders were branded as communist agitators by the union, and area judges issued injunctions to end the picketing. The Wildcat may have failed, but workers had pushed back against management offensives.
We've reached the end of this edition of the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly. Our creative collage of bits and pieces that can be found if you rummage around the many shows available at labourradionetwork.org. You can find complete versions of all the shows you heard today, and you can also find them by using the hashtag LabourRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Labour Radio Podcast Weekly was edited and produced by myself with Chris Garlock. Our social media is masterminded by Mr. Howard Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labour Radio Net. Find out more on our website at labourradionetwork.org. This has been Patrick Dixon for the Labour Radio Podcast Weekly. I hope you're able to join us again next time for another charcuterie board of Labour news, culture and history. Adios.